Some of you have attended earlier lectures that we've had in a series on rhetoric and discourse. I thought I might mention that the architect of this series and the idea of it is with us today, we're happy to say. He's Robert Payton, who was president for a number of years of the Exxon Education Foundation and will be joining the Miller Center in May as associate director. I wonder if Bob would stand up. The subject for today is in this realm on discourse. Discourse between the two cultures, science, religion, and humanities. And it's very appropriate that a person who has established himself for his scholarly work and teaching in this area speak to us on this subject. Father Malloy is well known for his research and teaching in the general area of ethics. He holds a PhD from Vanderbilt University in Christian ethics. He had master's degrees in both English and in theology at Notre Dame. He has been the number two academic officer of the University of Notre Dame for a number of years, and now, as most of you know, is president-elect of Notre Dame. These are the obvious credentials. There are two other ways one might introduce him, and in some respects, these are closer to my heart. One is that he was the outstanding long three-point shot man on the number one high school team as he grew up in Washington. The Archbishop Carroll team, which won 50 straight games and was number one in the nation. He also played at Notre Dame, and as Monk Malloy, he plays regularly with students at Soren Student Hall, where he lives and will continue to live as president rather than moving into the official residency which Father Hesburgh has occupied. At 6'4" and with the three-point rule being what it is, it's obvious that an institution not too far away from this place could have used him in recent months. The other personal introduction is that many of you heard Professor Stephen Kertész, the chairman for many, many years of the Committee on International Relations at Notre Dame. Kertész, had there not been a communist takeover, would have been a Hungarian foreign minister, and he lectured on foreign policy in this same room. Kertész saw candidates come and go, prospects appear and disappear, in the 35 years for which Notre Dame at least speculated about the succession to Father Hesburgh. And I happen to have been very close to him and had telephone calls the last two or three years of his life every Saturday morning. He wanted to talk. And one of the things we talked about again and again was, he said, you can relax. He said they'll look at the five priests, but there's little question among those of us who have been here for a long time that the man who is wholly qualified and admirably suited for the succession to Father Hesburgh is Father Edward Malloy. And we're pleased that early in his career as president-elect, he would visit this university. Father Malloy.
I don't know what Thomas Jefferson would have said about me appearing here on St. Patrick's Day and looking at some of the green in the audience here. But it's really a delight to be here. I made a visit to Charlottesville about two or three years ago, I don't remember exactly, to give a presentation before the local Notre Dame Club. And I had an opportunity at that point to tour the campus and get a sense of the beauty of the design that Jefferson had, but also to see something about the surrounding area and the rolling hills. Those of you who've been to South Bend know we have a relatively flat land there, and it's nice once in a while to see some hills, if not some mountains as well. I understand that my function here is to engage in a conversation with all of you. And although the topic that I have been assigned and would like to reflect about could well suit itself to simply having me talk at you and you passively sitting there pondering and either rejecting or accepting what I had to say, what I would like to do is to speak, as I think the context demands, for about 30 or 40 minutes and then allow you to have at me. And I would take that as part of the process by which I can clarify my own ideas more effectively and also hear from some of the things that you might have to offer. It is clear to me that any of us who live in multiple worlds, I as a priest, as a Catholic Christian person who belongs to a particular religious denomination and tradition, as a teacher and a practitioner of the science of theology and a subspecialty of Christian ethics, and as a university administrator, am sometimes embarrassed by those who claim to represent any of those worlds. It is possible for religious people to be very narrow-minded and unaware of what's going on around them and the changes that are demanded by our culture and our time and history. It is possible for theologians to be so self-satisfied and convinced that they've risen above the human condition that they really don't take concrete human experience into account or see their responsibility for the ramifications of what they have come to theoretically. And it is possible for university administrators and all of those who would speak on behalf of the intellectual life to have such a restricted notion of what a university is about that it would be as if religion had no place there, or as if religion could so circumscribe the conversation that we would have such a parochial understanding of a university that it would cease to be that in any real sense of the terms. What I'd like to do, just to give you a brief sense of the flow of my presentation, is to begin with a couple of presuppositions, all of which would demand whole books, but I'm simply going to assert them and give some indication of why I would say what I do. Then I'd like to make reference to some obstacles or problems in the area of the relationship of science, religion, and the humanities. And then I would like to move to something that I'm more accustomed to doing, and that is to reflect about some issues which allow us to see the sometimes precarious relationship in the conversation and rhetoric that comes forth from the various institutions that are represented by science, religion, and the humanities. Let me begin with my presuppositions. I believe that there is no such thing as a value-free science, not a very original claim. And there are all kinds of epistemological presuppositions built into that claim. Max Weber, one of the founders of what we know as sociology, Thomas Kuhn, and others have reflected for all of our benefit upon the kind of relativity built in to the questions that are asked and to the resulting answers that might be obtained from scientific research. We all would like to make some kind of claim for objectivity in our search for the truth. We would like as much as we can to free ourselves of bias and prejudice and ideology in the sense of false consciousness. But in order to achieve that state, it seems to me, we would have to become so ethereal that we would resemble the angels that are spoken about in theological speculation. I think human beings, those who practice the various sciences, are always going to bring their humanness to the endeavor. Part of what they bring are various kinds of value identifications and commitments. Whether those values come out of the Enlightenment or out of a specific religious tradition or out of Marxist perspectives on reality or from wherever they might come, they are in fact full of values in some sense of that term. The questions that we ask, at least partially, determine the answers that we are able to obtain. The so-called scientific method, with its attempts to get at data and to develop and test out hypotheses and regular explanations of why things are the way they are a function, I take it, of the curiosity and inquisitiveness of human beings. And even within the context of graduate education and of the financial support structure that often comes from the federal government or private institutions, all of that leads us in certain directions. It is interesting to me as an ethicist that there has been a burgeoning of interest in the last, say, 20 or 25 years, first of all, in the area of biomedical ethics. Why? Not because everybody was innately interested in that, but because the money was there. And you had the establishment of groups like the Hastings Center in upstate New York, or middle New York, the Kennedy Center, affiliated with Georgetown University, and many other think tanks since that time. There's also been an interest in the question of nuclear strategizing. And so we have a series of think tanks like the Hudson Institute. All of that has led scholars in a direction that might have been different if money had been available elsewhere. And the same thing, of course, is true more recently in a set of issues in business ethics. We have become focused on the economy today, at least with regard to ethical considerations in a way that was not true two or three decades ago. My second presupposition is that science is or can be a vocation. A vocation. The language of Beruf, which was employed in a very interesting way by Martin Luther in trying to describe what it meant to be a Christian in the world. And that language is unnecessarily, in my own tradition, so often employed simply for commitments of life that go along with ministry. I think in the time since the Second Vatican Council, we have rediscovered a broader based notion of what it means to say that I have a vocation or calling to a particular form of life with all of the discipline and rigor that that demands, but also with the exaltation that can be part of the results of giving oneself over to that endeavor, the sense of a commitment to the pursuit of the truth. I really do believe that science is and can be a vocation in that sense of the term, and that from my vantage point, any search for the truth can be a route to God. Whether it is for a given individual or for a community of scholars, well, that will only be determined by their individual and collective histories. But I believe that science can be a calling, a rich and fruitful way of trying to arrive at a greater approximation of the truth. And if that is the case, then I see it as something that a person from my particular tradition can well be called to and give him or herself over to entirely. Third presupposition, the study of nature, including human nature, strives toward a unified theory. We are so fragmented and stratified today, hyper-specialized. It's like a physician who looks only at bones and not at the whole person, or people who are only interested in one dimension of human experience. It may be the best way that we can mobilize a particular group of people to have some fruitful breakthrough in terms of our knowledge and understanding. But it seems to me also the case that it is only when we try to incorporate that into some broader view of nature, including human nature, that we can really satisfy our curiosity about why things are the way they are and what it means to have some kind of creative interaction with the givenness, with the status quo that all around us. There is connected to a lack of an appreciation for the desire for a unified theory, a kind of disavowal of the results of our quest to understand. So what if my theory leads to certain results? So what if we can make some kind of connection between Hegel and Hitler? So what if somebody's theory about the worthwhileness of a certain component of the human family leads us to practices which are detrimental to the whole of civilization? It seems to me that built in to the particular study of some phenomenon, including the human phenomenon or part of it, is a demand that we try to see the connection between that bitter piece of knowledge and the way we perceive and understand all of reality around us. A fourth presupposition: reasons count. And that the weakest form of argument, even though a legitimate form, is the appeal to authority. Arguments count. I really believe that one of the richest parts of the particular philosophical and theological tradition that is my own, broader Western one, but also specifically in the Roman Catholic tradition, is a respect for reason. Not that the heart and experience and our feelings don't speak to us as well, but a confidence that given sufficient time and effort and goodwill, that people can arrive at a kind of working and effective consensus about matters of public dispute and disagreement. And that only if we trust in that process, only if we believe that words and pictorial representation and symbol can allow us to get at the truth and to communicate effectively, will we have some kind of handle that will allow us to make progress in mutual understanding. One of the greatest things that I fear in our particular moment, maybe it's always been present, is that people will simply pigeonhole those who disagree, will write them off, will so categorize them as irrational or oblivious to the truth that they will cease to try to communicate and cease, especially in the public forum, to arrive at some kind of consensus about troubling issues. Finally, I believe, as an ethicist, that one of the most difficult and perplexing things about the relationship between science and religion and the humanities is to figure out how we move from value language to normative language to principled language to rule-oriented language. How we go from the most general claims about where our heart is, symbolically or metaphorically, where we stand as a unique human being, what makes sense to us, what values attract us, give a power and a beauty and a kind of resonant spirit to our lives. How we make the passage from that to the more difficult description of normative kinds of claims which require precision of language to the step of principles, whether we think principles will enable us to make universal claims or whether they might have a prima facie status or whether we think they're just roughly useful. I think most of us would like, when it comes to public policy matters, to be able to move at least to the level of principle. Because if we can show the transition from values, which may be widely held, to principles, we can at least make some progress on matters of public conversation. And I take it that's part of the function of the center. When we come to the level of rules, of course, we'll always allow for greater range for disagreement and for exception making. That shouldn't surprise us. The stuff of everyday life is never entirely amenable to being subsumed under our categories of thought. It will always elude us to some extent. But I think we can make progress at this particular moment of our collective history in trying to describe the transition from values, at least to principles, if not always to rules. The second part of my presentation has to do with problems. What are the problems we can identify as we try to find some bridges across the bounds of science, religion, and the humanities? The first problem, from the vantage point of the religiously committed person, is what might be called the scientific imperative. Is it true to say that whatever we can do by way of research or exploration, we ought to do? And even more, that we ought to fund doing if we have an opportunity to commit our resources for that purpose. We are all aware at any given moment, because the federal government and major institutions, including the business community, are responsible for subsidizing most of the research that goes on in this community, that is the broader American community, there are choices to be made about where we should put our resources. It seems to me that the bald claim that there is such a thing as the scientific imperative and that all research that can be done ought to be done is misguided. For I think we need to make some correlation between the value commitments of our lives, what kind of information or knowledge we see to have the highest priority, and what kind of obfuscation might come from just a wholesale support of every possible route of exploration. We have the Dr. Frankenstein phenomenon, which suggests that some isolated researcher, privately supported, can well do anything that he or she would like, and then later on come back for approbation from the broader scientific community. It seems to me that one of the important notions of a profession is that there be some code, self-generated, or at least in conversation with the broader society, and that there be some procedures of adjudication of the code. And I think that ought to apply to the scientific community, whether the natural sciences or the social sciences. So I reject, personally, the untrammeled view that the scientific imperative ought to reign supreme. I think the scientific imperative, that is scientific research and the support for such, needs to be determined on the basis of the values of a given group or culture, and some hard choices need to be made along the way. A second problem has more to do with religion than science. That is, I think religions, whatever religious tradition, are inherently conservative, for they are the memory community that tries to keep alive some great events in the past, including its own foundation, and some effort to reinterpret that tradition for the present generation. There will always be a certain amount of suspicion about the new, about the radical, about breakthrough possibilities. I think you find that no matter what religious tradition you're referring to. You might find some areas that there is less of an attempt to preserve. But generally, every religious tradition will have some area of life or behavior that it will worry about its significance. whether we will lose the quality or the integrity of the past. We can look, of course, to some obvious phenomenon in Western history, the Inquisition, the rack, the ordeal, torture to obtain the truth, supposedly to obtain the truth. That was given approbation by theologians and religious leaders. In retrospect, that tradition seems to me to be a great aberration, just as I take the Crusades to be a great aberration from the vantage point of ethical theory. But for some period of time, it was considered to be the appropriate response to the new, the challenging, and the revolutionary. We can see the same thing in the response that were met by Galileo, Darwin, Marx, Freud, and so on. Every great revolutionary thinker of the 19th and 20th century was suspected by the religious leaders of the day, which doesn't mean there weren't any good reasons for that, but I think it reveals to us that religion is resistant to some extent, especially in its official statements, to the incursion, the breakthrough of new knowledge. And one of the challenges for the intellectual representatives of those traditions, including the Christian one, is to find an effective way to mediate the new knowledge and show that it's not totally incompatible with the tradition of the past. And as we will recognize, looking at some of the issues, it's not always so easy to pull that off. The third problem is fundamentalism. And what I mean by fundamentalism is not simply a certain kind of biblical fundamentalism, which is largely present in the Protestant world, but also present to some extent in the Catholic world, present in the Islamic world, and elsewhere in the Jewish world. But a fundamentalism is a kind of attitude that control of the text, the sacred text, is control of the thought processes of the adherents. An attempt to disallow any flexibility or any recognition of the history of ideas and the evolution of understanding or the importance of what is called hermeneutics or the science of interpretation. To be able to come to grips with that very complex methodological question is as important as anything else, I think, in trying to find a convenient way of a greater cooperation between science, religion, and the humanities. There is a kind of authoritarian fundamentalism, or fundamentalism with regard to authority as there is with regard to the text. Why is that the case? Because people are in fact threatened. And it is possible to picture the modern world in dire, apocalyptic terms. Everybody is going to hell in a handbasket. If you want to, you can write a cynical book at any given time of human history. There are plenty of examples in the world around us of why we should not buy into future means progress, inevitably, because that's very much a part of what has been proposed by intellectual leaders of so many generations. We are always looking to the future for fulfillment in this world. And one of the tasks of religion is to somehow interpret this world as not the be-all and end-all of existence. Immersion in it, maybe a transformative role within it, but not to see it as, in a sense, heaven on earth, or to live for the dictatorship of the proletariat, or some hope for promise in this world. Fundamentalism addresses a very basic human need for stability and order and assurance. And I think that all of us possess that desire to some extent. But I think it errs because it tries to base it too much in the wrong places. It tries to assure or guarantee access to the truth by controlling the text or controlling the process of communication within a religious tradition. All right, all of those are open to all kinds of demur and disagreement. Let me just list some issues. And I'm going to just cover these fairly quickly just to give you, from my vantage point, a series of issues that I think bring to the surface the tension between science, religion, and the humanities. Criminal behavior. I've done a little writing in this area, and so I've tried to acquaint myself. We know, if you study the history of criminology, you know, for example, that there have been various attempts by scientists to explain why people act the way they do. Not simply violating the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, but why they steal and wreak physical harm against one another, why they refuse to abide by the claims for the common good. One theory at a particular moment of history was our forehead shape, phrenology, that you could look at somebody's forehead, we can look around here, and see the criminals from the non-criminals, the psychopaths. And that was taken very seriously. You can go back in old criminological textbooks. I don't know if you ever looked at those, and you see the side view and the front view, and they black out the eye so you can't tell who it is, and you see these gigantic foreheads for among the criminal agents in prison. Of course, that was a very selective sampling. Another attempt was body shape. Ectomorphs and endomorphs and all that, you see these kind of somewhat nude shapes with the appropriate things blacked out, and then you see these big and then the thin. And there's all kinds of suggestions which were taken seriously as a kind of scientific accounting. More recently, we've had the XYY or the super chromosome, the super male chromosome claim that you could tell by doing certain kind of genetic checks who was going to have a propensity to be a sociopath. That had the potential of being a self-fulfilling prophecy. And fortunately, it never was borne out. But I think you find attempts by science, whether on natural grounds or social scientific grounds, to try to account for why we do evil. And from the vantage point of a theoretician of religion, claims about original sin or temptation seem to have as much credibility as the accounts that have been provided entirely on scientific grounds. Is it nature or nurture that leads us to do evil deeds to one another? On the basis of our theory, we might provide an account of moral accountability or not. Are criminals simply sick? Are criminals so environmentally determined they have no freedom left to control their behavior? Or is it in fact true that people can be held morally accountable for their deeds? It seems to me that there are partial explanations, influences, available on the basis of scientific evidence, but I have seen no persuasive and even plausible explanation for criminal behavior that does not take into account human freedom and the context within which human freedom is properly exercised. Derivative from all of that are what we do about criminals to shape them up. And so you have a great debate in our culture between deterrence, retribution and rehabilitation, or even isolation as a proper strategy of response. We had for a period of time the explanation behind our criminal justice system that we could rehabilitate criminals by putting them in jail. And there is no evidence that I think can carry the day that it works that way. And so I wrote an article one time that simply said, if you're going to put somebody in prison, the only reason for doing it is to isolate them for the common good. You don't necessarily deter, you might. It's hard to prove. You might believe in theories of retribution or righting the wrong. You might think you can rehabilitate, but I doubt it. But you sure can isolate. So you should only put people in prison that you think need to be isolated. We are in a great crisis in our society today about building prisons and having a higher proportion of the population in there all the time. But we can see the connection between the account we give of why people perform criminal deeds in the first place, why they're malefactors, and what we do in response to that later on, and how much we give moral accountability to that, which very much ties into value systems like religious traditions and adherence to codes that come out of religious commitments. A second question, alcoholism. Why are some people alcoholics and other people not? Is it a disease? I think there's good reason to believe that alcoholism is a disease, at least partially, and that we should treat people with all of the respect that goes along with that acknowledgement. But it also seems to be a function of social conditioning. If you live in a society where nobody drinks, you're liable never to discover that you're an alcoholic, or could be. The availability of alcohol opens up the possibility that somebody who is genetically predisposed, like Irish and American Indians, I don't know of any Irish family of any size that doesn't have at least one alcoholic member, including my own. I have two uncles. That's just to expect it. Now, I don't think that our family is any more to blame than any other family. But I think there's a genetic predisposition in the Irish bloodstream that makes alcohol more of a problem than it might be otherwise. And the availability and the social support structures for drinking a lot accentuate the possibility that it might be a problem for a given individual. But what about moral blame? We have this very curious phenomenon. The most successful therapy available for alcoholism is Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous claims to be a non-denominational, non-religiously affiliated group, but in the 12 steps, one must appeal to a higher power, some source outside of oneself, to whom one is accountable, and relative to which one makes amends, by going to all the people that one has harmed along the way and asking for their forgiveness if one can. And trying to be open and confessional, interesting, isn't it? Confessional in front of the group to get up and say, I am an alcoholic, and all of this flows from that. Religion has had a place. Drunkenness is a moral, blamable conduct. But is it only that? Science has forced religion to take into account a dimension of the experience of alcohol abuse that religion on its own grounds might never have had to do. And so we now find a boundary point where we have redescribed, even on religious grounds, alcoholism as a disease, but have tried to preserve the notion of moral accountability. Venereal disease and AIDS, could get into that forever, AIDS. Every day in every paper in America, there's at least two articles on AIDS. A consciousness raising. For a lot of reasons. It is possible, of course, to see venereal disease and or AIDS, especially sexually related AIDS transmission, as a punishment from God. And there are certain religious representatives that use that language. I think that's reprehensible myself. But it gets used that way. But it's surely the case that the more promiscuous one is in sexual action, the higher the chance of getting venereal disease and AIDS. So there is a connection. It isn't as if condom morality, give everybody a condom and we'll solve all of our problems, isn't fallacious in the sense it fails to give any accounting for discipline or control over one's behavior. One can debate whether one ought to do this for other reasons, but as a solitary strategy, it seems fated not to work to me. Is AIDS or venereal disease a medical problem, a potential for disaster, prediction that we will be having 100,000 people die by 1991, that there are 500,000 people infected in various parts of the country, that it's heterosexually transmitted in Africa and Haiti, that even if we controlled the homosexual experience and the drug experience, it still wouldn't solve the possibility of the transmission of AIDS. Is it a social problem? Is it an educational problem? But education presumes a certain configuration of values. Or is it a moral problem? Is it God's punishment? Is that adequate language to talk about what is a very complex experience? I don't think so. But it surely is used. Another area where science and religion come together. Let me get an even more controversial one. Race and ethnicity. Is there any correlation between race and ethnicity and intelligence? You know that debate. Do IQ tests or SAT scores, which are variable and predictable almost by race and ethnic background, have anything to do with truth or with standing, worthwhileness, right to education? Is the continuation of a divided society, even on college campuses, when we integrate college campuses and blacks hang together, whites hang together, Hispanics hang together, and so on, Asiatic students, what does that reveal about anything? Is the support structure in the primary and secondary schools sufficient to allow people to prepare for the kind of highly rationalized test with certain verbal presuppositions enough or not? What about athletic ability and musical talent and race? Why do so many blacks have an ability to jump higher and run faster than whites? And should white man's disease, we call it, those of us who play basketball a lot. I can't jump worth a darn. I'm not very fast either, so I had to make up playing basketball by being a good shooter and having a certain amount of finesse. But I've played against blacks my whole life, and many of my best friends are blacks. And I really haven't seen any scientists take on the issue why in the Olympics or why in basketball or certain kinds of things are blacks predominant. And what does that mean? Does that have a moral quality to it or not? Does that mean that every team ought to have affirmative action for whites? If you want to turn it around, reverse the intelligence quotient question. So there's a lot of stuff there which has to do with notions of social justice and the influence of religion and the question of competency that comes out of notions like race or ethnicity. And the resolution of those is not simple, but I think science and religion in a healthy interplay and the social sciences and the humanities force us not to settle for cheap answers to those, to keep going back at an adequate description and an even better analysis. There's a couple more obvious ones, nuclear power and nuclear deterrence strategy. The American Catholic bishops have a letter from several years ago which I think employed an excellent process. They went out in the highways and byways. They brought in experts from all sides. They put a draft out. They said, criticize the draft. Put another draft out. Criticize that one. Finally, the third draft was approved. And then they distinguish in their document of different levels of teaching. You can disagree with it or not. And they encourage actual disagreement about the concrete particulars, the recommendations they make. But the process itself is interesting, because it respects the intelligence and the rights of those who make up that religious tradition and even people outside of it to speak in an informed way on a controversial issue. And the same thing on the letter on the economy. It's interesting that before both letters in the final draft came out, a group of more conservative Catholics came out with their own letter saying, thank you, bishops, but we think we know more about this than you do. I think that's a very interesting process and very American in that sense. Only in America, probably, at least in the Catholic tradition, could we have pulled that off. And maybe one of the things the American Catholic experience has to teach the rest of the church is that it's possible and desirable, which is something that I would want to argue. Organ transplantation. I'm on the Indiana Governor's Commission on Organ Donation. And we have to recommend public policy with regard to criteria for patient selection, how we're going to foster the giving of organs. Should we take them? Should we presume consent unless proven the opposite? Or should we have a manner of giving consent for organ donation? At one time, that was a very controversial issue. Most people I know, assent to organ donation is a good thing, but it's a matter of how we do it and who gets access to it. And should the president be going on television arguing the case for a particular recipient, some little girl somewhere, when there's 50 or 100 or 1,000 other people who have equal claim to that same organ or to comparable organs? That's a matter where religion and the motivation people have for donating organs is very much related to the amelioration of a significant social biomedical problem. And finally, death and dying technology. We all know that we'd rather die with our boots on, that we'd rather be relatively in control rather than completely dependent upon those around us, strapped up, connected to all kinds of intensive care units, separated from the emotional and personalized support. And so we have the hospice alternative and various ways of counteracting what is a too great dependence perhaps on technology. But we are going through some continual discussions about the right to die, about the definition of death, about the kind of resources that we can afford to make available to people in the dying process. It is a very emotional and difficult conversation that involves religious affiliation, scientific research and the technology that emerges from that, and a public conversation about where the money ought to go. It is not clear that we can continue to go in the direction we are. The development of the notion of DRGs, diagnosis-related groups, with all that that's done to hospitals and competition for economic support for medical plans, it is redescribing the nature of American medicine, for better or for worse. I think religion and science and the humanities all have a role to play in this conversation. To conclude my opening comments, we live in a pluralistic context. Everybody knows that in this particular culture. I think as a result, public debate is crucial about these matters. Therefore, the work of the center and all the other efforts going on in our particular moment of history to help people become informed, to recognize the connection between the values that they have, whether religiously inspired or not, and the kind of citizenship responsibilities that we bear, that's particularly important, lest the decisions be made by the few, the so-called experts, or be made by default by those less qualified than ourselves to exercise our options. Secondly, we need to try to persuade rather than to coerce. And the temptation of the elite in religion, the elite in the intellectual life, the elite in the body politic, is always to do it on behalf of everybody else. We say on one hand, we trust the common lot of humanity, that this is a democracy or a republican form of government, and that's deeply rooted in our traditions and in our common life. And yet, we all think the masses are asses and the elite are effete, to sum it up. We suspect elitism, and we really don't have great confidence in the mass of humanity. And we struggle from the desire to be coercive, especially if we're gifted with words or with knowledge of the political process, to skip the steps that are necessary for people to know what they're doing and to give common assent to it. Finally, we will continue to live, I think, in an interdependent world where science, religion, and the humanities cannot go it alone. And whether one who is a scientist or a humanist is also a religious adherent or not, they must take that into account in doing their own work, in trying to appeal for support and in recognizing the rights of people who are religious to have a say in the decisions of the government, of university life, and the kind of priorities that we establish for ourselves as a people. I believe a university is the most fruitful place to promote that kind of conversation. It is my honor to have been chosen the president of a major university. It's even more of an honor to be chosen to come and to give a presentation on a great university like Virginia. And I hope that Notre Dame, Virginia, and all the other great universities and colleges of this country can serve not only the scientific community, but also the church, to keep us all honest and to keep us all in conversation. Thank you. I knew I was going to get asked that. The reason I didn't, because I knew I'd get asked it.
What is the question?
The question is about the recent statement that came from a congregation in Rome under the Roman, under the Pope's authority, which the Pope read and approved. There are a couple of levels I can answer that. One is, it's important to identify the status the document has. It is not a papal statement. It's not like an encyclical. It's not like a document of an ecumenical council. And those who put it forth would necessarily like it to be taken at the ultimate level of significance. It seems to me that the process that was used was not entirely adequate to the level of significance proposed internally in the document. I think there was a very limited contribution by the range of theological opinion and the range of scientific and medical experience. I think that affects the quality of the arguments and the information that's built into the document as I read it. I believe that the conclusions of the document are stronger than the methods used to argue the case. I think the methods employed in the document could have been used 150 years ago, or 100 years ago, or 50 years ago. I do not think that the notions built into it, which are completely consistent internally, are as persuasive as I would like them to be. Most of the disagreement within the Catholic community among ethicists about the elements taken up in there would revolve around whether a married couple could legitimately and morally employ in vitro fertilization, for example, for the having of a child. I think that there are at least plausible cases made for assenting to that that were not properly taken into account in the document. However, I would say, at least within my own religious community, and I'm pretty familiar with the range of at least Christian and Jewish responses to the biotechnology field, that there is a greater consensus of a negative sort about some of the procedures than there are about others. That there is a lot of people intuitively and maybe experientially as well, are suspicious about surrogate motherhood to a greater extent than they are in vitro fertilization for a married couple, although there's some resemblance in the kind of arguments you could make. But I would say the document intended to clarify from an official church standpoint what the prevailing, and at least in the authors of the document, perpetual teaching would be about matters of biomedical technology. I think it gives a clear answer. I mean, there's no quibbling, but in my own opinion, it's excessively clear about some matters that I think are still and have been open to debate for quite a while. I really think it would be better for the conversation to continue with that as a starting point, perhaps, and see what areas of disagreement still exist. If you broaden the debate to the broader community, it's clear that American medicine is the most advanced. I mean, it started in England, much of the technology, and it's applied some other places. Australia has done a lot of work, and India, ironically. But the United States is one of those areas that I think probably has as much to say from our experience in the medical community and the ethical community, and I do not think personally that that was sufficiently taken into account. So one can agree or disagree with the particular conclusions. If you ask me as an ethicist what I think of the methodology, I don't think it was as good as it should have been. Yes?
I believe you used the term the science of theology. Are you looking at an empirical sense or a disciplinary sense?
In a disciplinary sense. I think theology is a science, a legitimate science, in the sense that it has its own procedures, agreed upon methods of exploration, standards of argumentation, and historical tradition that one can become familiar with, for example, in doctoral studies, and that one then, in their journals, there are recognized outstanding theologians that one can study. There are some people that are given a greater, more of weight of influence at this particular moment of theological history, and that one needs to display sufficient acquaintance with that tradition and ability to employ its language and methodology in order to win acceptance as a qualified practitioner. So I don't mean theology simply as empirical study, but theology as a recognized discipline comparable in its own way to chemistry or history or law. Yes. Okay.
What do you think of the importance of teaching creationism in schools, or the recent court ruling in Alabama about secular humanism?
Well, I don't think the recent ruling in Alabama will stand the test of the appeals court. So I don't think that in itself is going to last in terms of the adjudication process. Creationism is an interesting thing because as a Catholic, I almost feel a certain distance from it. There was a time in Catholic theology where you could easily have had a creationist evolution controversy, but that is not where the mainstream of the Catholic tradition has absorbed modern biblical criticism. And once one has done that, I mean, even if you have to make some decisions about how far to push the methodology, there is a room for an interpretation of the texts that constitute the problem with regard to evolution. I don't think there's anything incompatible between certain basic notions of evolution and Christian belief systems, and the stories in the book of Genesis or various parts of the Old Testament. I do think, however, that those who object to a certain notion of evolution, which is either Darwinian survival of the fittest or a kind of embedded Enlightenment anti-theistic position, are well taken. And that it is possible, for example, the objection that somebody can do a history of America and not take into account the history of religion in America and the role of the churches, it seems to me that that's a very poor history that did not recognize that the churches have in many ways been the most important element in influencing the value system of the people of this country. And not particularly in the earliest stages. Very little of America was religious at the time of the Revolutionary War. It was really after the Second Great Awakening that one could describe America as a religious country. And the whole notion of the Bible Belt as the South, and preachers out on the horseback and the tent meeting, and all that really democratized religion in the American experience. And it's interesting that what happened in the Catholic world is it was only with the coming of the great waves of immigrants that there was a significant Catholic presence. The same thing with the Jewish presence in this society. So I would say that any set of textbooks, not so much based, I mean, I think it's possible to give a fair accounting of evolution. It's a theoretical position. And in that sense, it seems to account for a lot of phenomena in ways that nothing else does. But one can push it as an utter explanation, a nothing but explanation. And I think that would be exaggerated and inappropriate. So I think the critics are forcing certain elements of the scientific community to be more humble and limited and modest in the way they present scientific theory. But I think the evolutionist can say to the creationist that you cannot give as full an explanation of the world as we experience it as we can, and until you can, why should you put yourself up as an equal and adequate religious theory or scientific theory? That's my thoughts about it anyway. Yes.
I'd like to hear your thoughts about how you deal with the problem of society where nearly everybody is educated in only one of those three streams of thought. Either they don't even speak on the same terms, scientists and religious people, ethicists and humanists. How do you deal with the problem of those three groups communicating with each other since they're kind of distinct personalities, different factors?
Well, the easiest answer is for the same person to be in all three groups. Is it possible for a scientist to be a believer? Some could imagine that it isn't. I know people that I consider excellent scientists who are believers and also very well educated and open to the arts and to the broader notion of human well-being and need. If you don't find it in the same person, then I think human mechanisms like friendship and working on common projects and looking for areas of consensus and minimizing areas of conflict, just as you do with any other group, that where you have to start out not on the same wavelength. I think there's a skill in bringing that off, but what I fear most of all is where individuals who represent what might be three different strata of society sit back and just hurl diatribes at one another, and as a result, don't increase the communication at all, increase the level of suspicion and antagonism, and elicit from the other side something comparable. That's not my style, and I don't think it's, in the long run, all that productive. Maybe the best way to do it, and has proven that way in the 20th century, let me give you an example. We have a guy that graduated from Notre Dame named Jim Muller, who teaches at the Harvard Medical School, and he was one of the co-founders of Physicians for Nuclear Responsibility or something like that, which won the Nobel Prize. He learned Russian when he was at Notre Dame, and he got very concerned about the whole question of nuclear deterrence and the possibility of nuclear holocaust. When he went to Russia, he was able to speak the language of the people on some research projects. When the possibility came along of trying to bring Russian and American scientists together, he had a head start because he had already established a rapport with people on medical grounds, which then led to the broader concern about the survival of those two cultures, and which for him also tied in with his religious convictions as a Catholic. He had the occasion, when he went to the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony, of having another Russian physician have a heart attack on the stage. They came up to the stage some people were working on the physician. These are all, many of them are cardiologists. And the medical people in Sweden came along and said, he's dead, let's forget about him. He said, no, I think there's still a chance of saving him. He stuck with him and did therapy on him until he got to the hospital. The guy lived. And so in the very ceremony where they all got the Nobel Prize together, he saved the life of a Russian physician who has been very instrumental since then on getting greater cooperation from the Russians to make this thing have some chance of success. Now that's an example to me that nobody could have predicted or planned for, where getting involved in one project leads to a different level of conversation and mutual trust, and leads then to the possibility of getting other people involved in the same kind of conversation. Now beyond that, I don't have any magic scheme. Father Hesper, the present president of Notre Dame, has as his number one priority to work on, from within the thing that we call the Institute for International Peace Studies, on bringing people together. And he is focused on scientists, first of all, because he believes the scientists are most in touch with the potential for ill that goes along with the use of nuclear weapons. And because of that, they can have an influence on their culture that nobody else can have. And so we are bringing together at Notre Dame this summer a group of retired Russian generals and a group of retired American generals to sit around and talk for a period of time about their experience of war and about what they think of the nuclear question. We're bringing three people under 25 from Russia, three from China, three from the United States, two from Japan, two from France, England, and Germany, to spend a year doing a master's degree in peace studies together, as try to prepare a next generation of leaders to know each other, to speak the same language, and to have some common concerns that they can cooperate on. I mean, not just to brag about that, I think it's great that we're doing it, but that's the kind of thing that I think can work better than simply sitting back and saying those scientists are all just into their own thing and have no sense of humanity, and those humanists are out of it, and those religious people are Neanderthals. We got time?
Sure.
Okay, go ahead.
How do you see the future of the church in regards to vocations?
Vocations?
Yeah.
I think it's, you mean the Roman Catholic Church?
Yeah.
I think we're in trouble right now. That's when I think the number one problem in the Roman Catholic tradition is sufficient numbers and quality of clergy to take full advantage of the great burst of lay ministry that's taken place over the last 20 years.
I go to New York and I see all white-haired priests. And, you know, that's kind of depressing.
Maybe they die, they're here. To get respect. Yeah, I think institutionally
that. And
institutionally, that's the, I think there's ways to change that, but it's not within my power to do it. And I'm not going to tell you what, but you can figure it out for yourself. And I don't say that in some self-serving way. I just think, I mean, I've given my life over to this, and I want the church to flourish. And we turn out people at Notre Dame all the time. We're a very church-going campus. And then you get out and you see what it's like, and they come back and tell you horror stories about their local parish. I regret that. I lament it. And I try to affect it as much as I can, but we all have our limits. So you asked me, I told you. I mean, we in my particular community, it's been very fortunate, primarily because of the attraction of Notre Dame, to get good candidates and numbers that are adequate to our own needs, but that's not true of the church at large. And I think if that's not addressed, that it's going to be an even more important problem. I also believe that Americans, because of their pragmatic orientation, will not accept that for long. I don't care how conservative they are. They're going to start complaining very loudly, and maybe somebody will take notice eventually. I don't know what that has to do with the topic, but it's a good question. Anybody else? Yes.
I have so many views on research in the area of the need for fertilization.
what are my views on research or the use of in vitro fertilization?
The actual research, because there's been some debate.
Well, the main objections to in vitro fertilization that appeared in the literature early on were classic ones. Is it a threat to the notions that we have presumed about sexuality and the relationship between genital intercourse and the having of children? Is there something very precarious about blood bonding and the way that one identifies with a child as wholly one's own? I think that's a legitimate question. A second concern has to do with what has been called playing God, or presuming a kind of wisdom in the long run that only will be tested by time. Will we discover after the fact that we regret having promoted this kind of step? A third one, in the Steptoe and Edwards research in England, revolved around the rejection of some of the fertilized eggs. So that if you believe, as I do, that from the moment of fertilization, you have human life and therefore protectable human life, all things being equal, and you deliberately reject some of the fertilized eggs, then you are involved in an abortive process that needs to be evaluated in those terms. An objection that appears in this document, which I don't find all that persuasive, has to do with the way that the sperm is obtained, which could also be applied to some extent to the obtaining of the eggs from the woman. In the end, I suppose the real debate is this an excessive mechanization under the guise of doing good to infertile couples? Is an excessive mechanization of what are taken to be on other grounds natural processes? And will the results in the end destroy a very delicate fabric of the notion of family, of parental bonding, as we have known it throughout human history? And I don't think the answers are yet available to those questions. I think one needs to be wary and at least concerned about the significance of in vitro fertilization, even if restricted to a couple. But I think one can at least entertain the possibility that that can be a moral procedure, and then one can look at the arguments for and against. Once one extends it past the marital bond, then I think we have a different situation, and one that I would find morally objectionable myself, and on those grounds, and even more because of what I think it does. It is possible to the notion of family. It is possible now, obviously, to have five parents: the donor of the egg and the sperm, a host mother, and the nurturing couple. It is possible in the same way to have lesbian parents, homosexual male parents, single parents, and so on, elderly, juvenile. I mean, you can reconstruct the whole understanding of parenting on the basis of what is already available, no less the frozen embryos, the whole image of hatcheries that goes along with the Brave New World image. I mean, all of that is good reason, if not for alarm, at least for deep and consistent concern. And to that extent, I'm glad that a document came out that tries to force people to come to grips with this reality. So in saying, having some quibbles about some elements of it, particularly the methodology, I don't want to discount the importance of trying to address moral attention to these questions. But those are at least some of the issues that I have seen and would believe are present as far as ethical analysis goes. Yes?
Currently in the American Catholic community, there's a great deal of percentage towards faith teaching. And my question is, as an ethicist, as an academician, what is your view on that dissent, and does it conflict with being a priest, being a representative of the Lord, and what is your view on the quick reaction and a decisive action when the dissent has been repeatedly vocal?
Well, it's hard to know where to begin on that. I think if you've ever studied church history, whether Catholic church history or Protestant or any church history, you know that there are certain periods that are more conflictive than other periods. And there are certain issues that rise to prominence that become a kind of test of orthodoxy. It's lamentable from my point of view that so much of the discussion about authentic teaching and orthodoxy has revolved around sexual morality. It seems to me that there's a whole wide sweep of concerns, of which that's only one part, that one might employ to see where somebody is within the broader context of the Catholic or any other community. It's interesting for me, for example, that when Michael Novak and William Simon and William O'Brien and others came out with a letter about the nuclear question, that they pushed the matter of the criteria of just war past where the tradition had. For example, William O'Brien said in his response to the bishop's letter, and this is from a conservative perspective, that the principle of non-combatant immunity or discrimination was not an overarching moral principle that should stand behind any judgment about war, but rather it was a beginning point or a prima facie duty, and that the evil of the Russian system and its threat to all the freedoms that we know was sufficient to override, in this particular case of nuclear strategizing, that we should be prepared to fight a limited nuclear war. And he himself argued the case that we should start by limited targeting, but be prepared, if we had to go to kind of total devastation targeting. Now, that goes against the grain of all that I know in the evolved just war tradition as it came out of the Catholic tradition. He is a dissenter. Michael Novak argues the case for an extension of the notion of right intention, which is way beyond what I think has been true in much of the discussion in the Catholic community and even in the broader Christian community about right intention as a criteria of just war. I don't say that they shouldn't be able to do that, but it all depends on what issue you're pointing to, on where dissent lies and how much freedom of conversation people would like to allow for. I am a, if you would put me on the spectrum, I'm on the progressive spectrum when it comes to, especially in a university context, a maximum range of the exploration of ideas and allowance for disagreement. I think that's the proper context within which to do it. It doesn't mean that individuals shouldn't have to fess up and say, I'm just me, or I'm in opposition to what is the inherited traditional position. I think that needs to be part of the good teaching and good writing. But I think that in the Catholic intellectual world today, that the great hope is in this country right now, that we have more qualified and committed scholars than any other part of the world. I think that the European tradition is much more suspicious of what goes on here than they ought to be, especially if you look at the quality of life and worship with regard to the Catholic community in general. I wish people would spend more time here and learn firsthand and experientially the kind of things that are going on and the wide range of issues that are being taken up, and what the American political tradition has done to the notions that Catholics have of what ought to happen in the life of the church. So I think the university community needs to try to preserve that as much as possible. That doesn't mean that we should be centers of some kind of hostile opposition. But there are always going to be individual celebrated cases. Sometimes the people foster it for their own reasons and sometimes not. Notre Dame has, at my institution, we have the most conservative Catholics represented and we have fairly liberal Catholics represented. We have very few really radical types, I would say, on our faculty. But and all the range in between. I like it that way. I think it's healthier than just being identifiable as a kind of this kind of Catholic university. Now, whether Rome's going to like that or not, that's not for me to say. It's for me to try and represent it well and to build bridges rather than try and breed conflict. But that would be my own position about it.
Whatever our differences, some of the issues that were mentioned, it seems to me on one issue we can be in full accord, and that is that intellectually, morally, scientifically, Notre Dame in the years ahead is good hands. Thank you very much.
Thank you.